You're listening to SBS On The Money with Ricardo Gonçalves.
Everyone, welcome to the SBS On The Money podcast for this Thursday, the 30th of October, 2025. Later in the podcast, we'll take a look at the AFR Young Rich List and find out how people under 40 are building wealth. But first, the Australian share market, where the ASX 200 fell by 0.5% to 8,885. That's as the US Federal Reserve cut interest rates by 25 basis points overnight to a range of between 3.75 and 4%, but said that a December rate cut is not a done deal. So what does it mean for investors and for investment into artificial intelligence? For that and more, I spoke with market analyst Evan Lucas. Evan, what's driving market sentiment at the moment?
Well, let's be honest, there's only one thing driving market sentiment at the moment, and that's AI investment and where AI is going. I mean, if you strip out everything that's exposed to AI and have a look in the US, for example, the overall performance of the S&P 500 is pretty negligible. And if you look then also, let's take Nvidia now, which everyone's loving to talk about, is it's a $5 trillion US dollar company. I mean, that's bigger than the GDP of Japan, India, the UK. But again, if you strip all of that out, that's almost 10% of the S&P in itself. So all of that investment is going one way. And again, it's so hard to argue against it because clearly it is designed and is seen as the augmentation of the future. But it does also mean that we get this question about frothiness, about bubbles, and whether or not it's actually creating an inflation problem as well. Because as we've seen with Microsoft here in this country, are they actually putting the cost of AI into their already existing systems and charging us above and beyond what they're supposed to? So for that in itself, all of those put together about why there is only one investment in town, and it's AI, because it's super exciting. It clearly will be the future. But at the same time, it's not necessarily proving to return itself to profit yet, considering the revenue drive that's there.
And there with Microsoft, I think you're referring to those allegations by the ACCC about the Copilot product on those Microsoft 365 plans. On AI, what's interesting at the moment is that overnight, Meta said that it would be investing a lot more money now and into the future into developing and researching, I guess, AI, and essentially pushing back expectations for returns and profit, that sort of thing, right? But it comes at a time where US interest rates may not fall as hard as first thought, right? So isn't a lot of this investment coming in through into AI because of these expectations of low rates? Overnight, the Fed Reserve cut rates by 25 basis points, but said, hey, another cut in December is not a done deal. What does all of this mean?
Yeah, so you're right. There has been the premise that's been put in, particularly by the bigger end of town and by just business investment in general, is that the lowering of interest rates, not just in the US, but across the whole world, is on the idea that they know they have to improve technology. They know they have to, inverted commas, improve productivity, which they'll argue what AI can do. But to do that and to get that investment, you obviously have to make the upfront costs. And so if the investment loans, business loans, debt that the businesses hold is reducing because rates are falling, let's take the US again, the US Federal Reserve reducing that lending scenario isn't falling as much, the amount of investment is lower because the amount of interest repayments will be higher than forecasted into their numbers. Now, Meta is using a nice little loophole there in their third quarter update from their third quarter numbers that, yes, if rates don't fall as far as we're expecting, the cost of borrow that we have will be higher. Therefore, the gearing will impact the overall business direction. That's all well and good. What is clear, though, from what Meta is saying, no matter what interest rates are, they're going to make the investment. And I think that needs to be put in there very clearly, that they are going to make the investment. They know they have to. They are still the leading social engineered platform on the planet that's in AI. You can probably put TikTok to one side with all the issues that's going on around the US arm of TikTok. So Meta is front and center, the AI hub for this number. So I get that point. I get the link. As I said, we're seeing that also here in Australia, that the discussion is about investment in the future. You look at what CBA is doing about how much money they're investing into their AI tools. They've made mistakes. They admit them, but it's the same thing. All of them are saying the same answer, just in a more roundabout way, which is that the investment in technology is going to be front and center for all of their capital expenditure and operational expenditure for not just this financial year, but the foreseeable future as we all move into what was already a digital world, but the hyper-digital world.
So what does that, if this is a trend that's happening in a company like Meta, as you mentioned, if it's going to be replicated by other large companies, what does this mean for investors and the way they're investing at the moment and expectations for returns?
So let's go back to NVIDIA. So NVIDIA is probably the answer to that. And the fact that, don't forget, investment is always thinking 12 months ahead. So we are thinking about what revenue will NVIDIA have in 12 months' time to make it a $5 trillion company. What you're hearing then from an investment decision, like what Meta is saying, is that that investment is not only correct, inverted commas, not advice, but also that the probability of further investment into the industry is only going to get higher. It's why you are seeing, prophesizing from Microsoft around how fast and how big the AI revolution will be for Microsoft is in the 10 to 20 times of what it currently is valued. I mean, that's just an extraordinary amount of money when you think about what kind of size they think it will be. It also still means that the investor is chasing that. And it's the correct term. They are chasing it. That's why we get this question, is this a bubble or are we at the start of the frenzy? The whole information line at the moment is we are either at a frenzy or we're at synchronization. That's the transition that we talk about in the tech space world in investment. We're probably at frenzy. There will be messiness. There will be pullbacks. Maybe the US Federal Reserve not cutting rates in December is that frenzy point where that frothiness gets a bit hard, that you can't just go out and borrow to invest into AI because AI is going to slow down because the investment itself is going to slow down. I understand that's a roundabout way of answering it, but that's where we sit, right? That's the world we are in. That's why people compare it to the dot-com bubble. It's very similar in its view. The difference between the dot-com bubble and the AI current scenario, bubble or not, we'll make that debate up in a couple of years' time, is that this has been backed by serious coin with companies that have vested interests, that have long-term sustainable revenues outside of the AI system, that are looking to enhance their business rather than start their business. So the foreseeable future and the investment into that future is still very strong.
Okay, a couple of final questions just on the local market, right? Yesterday, we saw those higher than expected inflation numbers at 3.2% above the RBA's target band. To what extent now is the market factoring the chance of a rate cut in the future?
Yeah, look, if you had a look at it live when that was dropped yesterday, at one point it actually dropped negative. Now, what that means is that it wasn't factoring in cuts, it was actually factoring in a 10% chance of a hike. That obviously has dissipated out. But the market has completely factored out rate cuts. It's now only got one rate cut probable by June next year, not penciled in, probable. The last I checked on the 30-day interbank futures was it was sitting at about 70% that we will get a rate cut in June next year. Now, that's a long way away. There's a lot of data to come out. Clearly, the inflation data for the fourth quarter of this calendar year, which comes out at the end of January, start of February, will now be just as important as what we saw yesterday. It will also be the GDP figures come out about the same time. Are we having a scenario where inflation's holding up and growth is going down? That's going to be the conundrum the RBA is now facing. But if you listen to their chief economist and Sarah Hunter, you listen to what Michelle Bullock is saying, they are still laser focused. Let's not escape that fact on inflation. The final thing that gives you the silver lining, if you do want to find one, if you look at the monthly figures yesterday inside that full quarter, the October monthly inflation feed was at 2.8%. So it is below that 3.2. There will be things that filter out. But the other catch is the final part of the energy rebates, they're gone by Christmas. So there is push-pull. In my view, and where we currently can view it, the probability of a rate cut in the foreseeable future, and I'm talking the next 5 to 6 months, looks very dim. Is there a probability of one more before the rate cycle comes to the end? Yes, because the RBA is still forecasting that it needs to take its foot off the brake, and it still openly says that it's in restrictive territory. The question will be from that, once they do it, how fast could they ratchet rates up? And that's the next point. If inflation holds at the 2.8, 2.9 level, they don't want it to be at the top end of their 2 to 3% band. They need it to be in the middle or falling to the bottom end. Overshooting is something they definitely don't want to do. And they are very conservative, and that's why I can see the market only giving themselves one rate cut to go, and they're still a long way away from that happening.
That's Evan Lucas there, market analyst. Now, with that all in mind, I also asked him, where are the opportunities for investors?
I still think the opportunity is clearly in what we've probably seen in developing as a theme over the last sort of couple of months. The critical minerals discussion is clearly the forward future, and the electrification of the world, Australia will be the forefront of that. We have the minerals and the materials for that. It is a longer term game. It needs to be made very clear. There has been bumpiness here, but you look at what's going on in gold, but you then look at, you know, the probability of returns of rare earths, the probability of returns for even demand for things like nickel and lithium is going to be interesting. The other one is whether or not we can start to see some of our services businesses become real global players in this space. And that is the other thing that I'm watching for. Okay, they might not list here, but in the next 12 months, Canva is going to list. And players like Canva is what I think you need to look at, is they are going to be the next part of the digital revolution and the hyper-digital revolution that you and I have just talked about. We have companies like that here in Australia. We need to attract them to stay listed in this country rather than chasing the money that comes overseas. The only advantage that I can talk about that is that thankfully we are in a global world, and investing globally is much, much easier. So even if somebody like Canva does invest in the States, which clearly they're going to do, we as Australians can still invest in it.
That is market analyst Evan Lucas there. Now let's take a look at who is making money. The tech and retail entrepreneurs, well, they've dominated this year's Financial Review Young Rich list. Canva founders Melanie Perkins and Cliff Obrick on top, worth $18.5 billion. They're followed by crypto casino founder Ed Craven, along with blockchain infrastructure and gaming brothers James and Robbie Ferguson. There was also strong migrant representation on the list this year. So to tell us more about how young people are making money, I spoke with AFR Rich List editor Yolanda Redrup. Yolanda, when you look at the list, what kind of trends are you seeing for those on top? And I guess what industries are they in?
Yeah, there's definitely some clear trends that come through. It's a trend we've seen for the past couple of years, and it's definitely stayed true this year, is the dominance of the tech sector. Of the top 10 people on the list this year, 8 of them are actually in tech or tech adjacent industries like fintech and crypto casinos. And across the whole list, we classify 37 of the entrants in the tech sector, which is by far the most of any industry. And that's sort of followed by retail. So tech and retail dominate that list. Of the retailers, there's 21 in the Young Rich this year. So those two industries by far make up largely sort of 50% of the list. Then if you actually look at that top 10 and the proportion of wealth that's occupied there, you see quite strongly just the dominance of two individuals, which is the Canva co-founders, Melanie Perkins and Cliff Obrett. Their wealth at $18.5 billion actually makes up more than 50% of the top 10 and 41% of the overall list, which is quite astonishing, to be honest. Now, they're in their late 30s now, 38, 39, so they're going to age off in a couple of years, and it will be really interesting to see what happens then. We'll see if there's another founder that sort of grows into that kind of valuation, or there's a chance there's going to be quite a big gap to fill and we could go for some years without new records being set.
So it sounds like to hold a lot of wealth, you need to potentially be a retailer that operates within the AI space if you combine the two, right? But when you look at the entrepreneurs on the list, what characteristics do they all hold?
Yeah, they definitely share some characteristics. Not surprisingly, you see people with admirable work ethics. They're largely self-starters. They're people that aren't afraid to think outside the box. And you'll also see people that just have this entrepreneurial spirit in their DNA. So you talk to them and their parents often ran small businesses, or they might have been kids that had side hustles themselves when they were growing up. Like, quite commonly, I'll hear stories of the lemonade stands or selling their toys, or, you know, making things to sell at local market. So for many, they were kind of in this path from their very sort of early years of their lives.
AI is obviously a big theme in the list and in the markets and everywhere we turn. To what extent are Aussies making money from it, especially those young Aussies?
Oh, definitely. That's probably been one of the biggest differences we've seen from 2024 to 2025, is we are now seeing wealth being created by this booming industry. So this year, when you look at the debutantes, we've got our top-ranked debutant, Andrew Tullock. He's actually an Australian co-founder of one of the sort of hot Silicon Valley AI startups of the day, Thinking Machines Lab. He's an interesting story. He started the business with Miramarani back in January. His wealth is very much tied to equity in that business. But just after we'd cut off valuations and sent the magazine, he actually announced that he is going back to his former employer, Meta, which I'm sure comes with a very healthy pay packet. So that will have implications for his standing next year. But we've got many others too. We've got Oliver Curtis and Tim Rosenfield, who started Firmus, which has been making headlines lately. They're in the AI infrastructure space, so building data centers that cater to these really big AI companies. We've got Stephen Hind of Lorikeet, who's also in it this year. They do sort of an AI concierge. And then on our main list, we've got William Roberts. So he's been on it before. But he was one of the biggest movers this year because his business, Irem, has had this massive share price increase on the back of its move into AI infrastructure. So we've seen these Australians, most of which are sort of playing on the edges and sort of building these additional layers to AI, being it applications or infrastructure. But that wealth creation's really flowing through that whole sector now. And we're also seeing a situation where their net worths are actually rapidly increasing, you know, multiple times over every year. So in both of these cases of Stephen Hine and also Firmus, we're looking at their valuations increasing every sort of 6 months and in quite a significant manner. So I think we're going to see this trend stay for at least the next couple of years while there's really this race going on to build the next generation of major tech companies.
We've spoken a lot about AI, retail. What we haven't spoken about are those entertainment stars or the sporting stars. Is there money there?
Yeah, there is. And we do see that every year. It's another dominant industry amongst young rich. So there's 14 athletes on the list this year. Of them, six of them are actually basketballers. So if you're tall and athletic, that's probably your best bet at making a fortune. But Australia also bats above its weight in the Formula One. And you see that throughout the other sort of divisions as well. But one of our debutants this year is Oscar Piastri. He'll be a name I'm sure is familiar to everyone tuning in. He's had this incredible season, is currently second in the driver rankings by only 1 point, and it's been great to watch his performance this year.
And so finally, what about the role migrants are playing on that list?
We definitely get a strong representation of migrants on the young rich list, much like we do the main rich list. And that's really exciting to see the success that they're being able to create within this country. One of the standouts this year was Anna Podolsky. She immigrated from the Ukraine when she was only two, and she's now behind a business called Laika, which is making homemade pet food. So she comes onto the list with an estimated net worth of 220 million as by far the largest shareholder in this pet food business. And what she's doing is she's actually adding, you know, thousands of years to the lives of Australian dogs by improving their nutrition and giving them what they need to actually live fruitful lives where they stay healthier for longer, they've got better quality of life, their skin improves, their teeth improve, and they're just staying alive for longer thanks to the work she's doing with this business, Laika. And then we've also got amongst our new faces this year, we've got two Iranian immigrant stories. They're the women who are behind a fashion label called Meshki. Now, Shadi Kaur, she actually came to Australia as a teenager. She spoke very little English. And when she was in university, she met a lady called Natalie, who they ended up going into business together. They put in about $200 each. And now, you know, less than 2 decades on, their business is worth a couple of hundred million dollars. And they've had remarkable success with their clothing label, Meshki.
Hey, Yolanda Redd up there from Financial Review. She is the Rich List editor there, and she wraps up the podcast for this Thursday. Remember to give it a like, review, and subscribe on Apple Podcasts and Spotify as well. And I will see you tomorrow.
This SBS On The Money podcast is provided for informational purposes only and should not be understood as constituting advice or a recommendation. It is not personal advice and it does not consider your personal circumstances or objectives. You should contact a licensed professional before making any financial decision.
This SBS On The Money podcast is provided for informational purposes only. Content on this podcast should not be understood as constituting advice or a recommendation. It is not personal advice and does not consider your personal circumstances or objectives. You should contact a licensed professional before making any financial decision.